Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is someone really interesting, a biologist, Mary Olson, who is the Southeast Regional Coordinator with the National Information and Resource Service in the United States, an organization that provides information to citizens concerned about nuclear power, radioactive waste, radiation, and sustainable energy issues. In her 21st year of this work, Mary has come to focus on the disproportionate impact that exposure to ionizing radiation has on women and children. Her recent paper, entitled Atomic Radiation is More Harmful to Women, reveals information the National Academy of Sciences BEAR 7 report. BEAR stands for Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation. The BEAR 7 report includes but does not discuss. Welcome to the program, Mary Olson.
I'm so glad to be here.
Now, Mary, I think just from a personal perspective, I'd like you to describe to the audience how you got involved in the whole issue of radiation as a young woman and what you were doing at the time when you got involved.
Well, it really goes back to 1984 when I was a recent college grad and had taken a research job in a medical school, actually the Yale Medical School in New Haven, Connecticut. And within the first 2 weeks in this new job, I was accidentally exposed to far higher levels of radionuclide than most labs have. These were millicurie levels of phosphorus and unmarked object that had been used by a graduate student days before. And I used it for about a week with no protection, and as a result got a pretty hefty internal dose, which for this type of radioactivity, phosphorus 32, most of its impact would be from internal exposure. That happened because I got it all over my hands and didn't know it. Can't sense radioactivity, can't smell it, can't see it, certainly didn't taste it. Anyway, I discovered by accident that this had occurred, and quite frankly, Helen, the only thing that saved my sanity during the next few months at all was discovering a book called Nuclear Madness by Dr. Helen Caldicott.
I've got goose pimples, Mary. How did that save your sanity?
Because you spoke the truth, and all the people around me were trying to cover all this up with lies. Really? Oh, it's no problem. Marie Curie lived to be an old lady, da-da-da-da-da.
Really?
You know? That kind of thing. And in that environment of the research setting, nobody talks about radioactivity as any kind of hazard at all. They kind of act like the more radioactive their lab coat is, the hotter, more macho you are. I mean, I discovered after my brush with this stuff, I went through the buildings with a Geiger counter and discovered hot spots in the cafeteria, on chairs, in the library, on books, throughout the stairwells. It was really quite appalling.
Really? And this was Yale.
Yeah.
I thought that there was some mechanism by which some sort of organization in America was responsible for monitoring labs at universities and medical schools to make sure they comply with certain standards. Is that not true, Mary?
The interesting thing is that at least at that time in the early 80s, individual rooms were licensed as licensed radioactive areas, but nobody was responsible for the halls or the stairwells or any quote-unquote non-radioactive place, including the bathroom doorknobs and things like that. So people would walk through the halls carrying their little test tubes from one lab up to the central scintillation counter. It was really quite a mess. And I sometimes feel very bad that I didn't return to working on that after my 5 years of recovery. But instead, I ended up being called by little, before email, 1989, 1990, little envelopes in the mail coming from Nuclear Information and Resource Service, where I've been working for the last 21 years. This is before I got this job. I got these little envelopes, and I finally opened them. I don't know who put me on the mailing list. And inside were information about the U.S. federal government wanting to deregulate radioactive waste to allow it to be recycled into consumer products with no warning or labeling at all, averaging doses across the entire population. I realized that what happened to me in the lab could easily happen in a Kmart store, for goodness sakes, or a Target store. I mean, any retail setting, if you allowed the recycling of radioactive waste, and then they were going to put a certain other amount of it into municipal landfills. And I also knew that this could jeopardize the groundwater. So within a year, I had mobilized myself to work to stop that policy, ended up being hired by Nuclear Information and Resource Service, and we did get Congress in 1991 to repeal, well, to direct the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to put that whole policy on hold. And we didn't actually get an outlawing of deregulation, but at least we had a major reversal of that policy from Congress that year.
Well, now, Mary Olson, when you say your 5 years of recovery, I don't think you suffered from any physical abnormalities from your exposure.
That's not true, Helen.
Oh.
That's not true at all.
What happened?
And quite frankly, I never did pursue the legal action that I filed, in part because some deep wisdom in me said, you know, I don't have a community of support. I don't have money. Yale is one of the largest nonprofit corporations on the planet. I may have brilliant attorneys, but the problem is I'm going to have to hold the posture of a victim. And quite frankly, I'd rather recover.
Oh, Mary.
And so I basically ran away and hid and lived in a place where I could eat nice, clean, healthy, homegrown food and sleep in the same bed every night. And I wasn't exactly stress-free, but I had a very different kind of stress helping to run a children's camp and retreat and conference center. Built a great set of skills, organizational skills, and then took all that and my regained health and applied it to working nationally and globally on these issues, which I think was a great set of decisions. But let me just briefly tell you that I never had to prove anything to anybody, so this is my own experience. I'm not saying I have proof. But within a very short period, like a week of the radiation exposure, I got what is a genetic condition in my family, hit me, boom, like 20, 30 years ahead of schedule. My entire back went out. I started having pain in my left and right hip joints, which was not arthritic, and this is a bone seeker. Phosphorus goes into the bone. I had a diminution of my menstrual cycles to the point where I had 3 years with none.
Goodness me.
I started being chemically sensitive, like people sometimes are for their whole lives. This lasted for about 3 years for me, where I just couldn't be around people with perfume or any type of VOC, volatile organic compound. It would just give me all these bizarre symptoms of headaches and body pains. And pretty much I had to, you know, really lower my activity levels because of a sort of general overall fatigue and sort of fibromyalgia-type symptoms. So it was a pretty major impact. And the most enduring impact, of course, was that I was 25 years old. I had had no children. And I quite frankly couldn't face what would happen if I had an abnormal pregnancy.
Oh,
and so
Mary.
I have lived my life without children.
Oh, Mary.
So I wouldn't say that I had no physical impact.
Yeah.
I had a lot of physical impact.
Wow, I'm almost speechless.
Well, a lot of people go through this and they don't even know why. They don't know what's causing it. And in many cases, it's occupational exposures. In other cases, it may be the radioactive fallout from a nuclear power plant a couple hundred miles away that you didn't realize you got when you got soaked in the rain.
That's right. If I'd been around, you know, maybe I could have supported you and helped you. But anyway,
Wait a minute. We've got to finish the story because you did. In my very first year at Nuclear Information and Resource Service, you and I started exchanging faxes. And I had the great honor and privilege of collaborating with you on your revision of that book that saved my sanity. That was the year that I helped you in your revision of Nuclear Madness.
That was 1995.
Well, we started on that in 91.
Well, Mary,
and that was my first year at NIRS. So you were there, Helen.
Well, you were there for me too, weren't you, Mary?
Well, both my parents were scientists, and so happily I had the scientific method well ingrained in me before any of this happened. It did help a lot.
Okay, so you're highly intelligent. You're on to the nuclear issue because of a personal devastating experience. And I've worked with you, Mary Olson, very closely over the years, and the Nuclear Information Resource Service, which anyone can access on the internet, NIRS it's called, Nuclear Information, has been absolutely stunning in its ability, with a very few number of people, very small number of people, to fight the nuclear power industry almost single-handed in the courts, with a huge amount of knowledge in their armamentarium, and have held the nuclear industry at bay in many areas. And Mary's been a part of that for so long. Now, what I really wanted to talk to you today about, Mary, is your recent work investigating the great sensitivity of women and children to radiation compared to men. And it's a big subject, but I want to really get stuck into it so the audience can learn a lot about radiation exposure. Where would you like to start?
Well, I want to tag it in time and say that it really is the disaster, the Fukushima disaster in Japan, that forced me to take seriously some questions I had received from people. I do a lot of public speaking in grassroots communities, and several times women had raised a hand and said, isn't it true that women have more sensitivity or more vulnerable to radiation than men? And certainly we've been saying forever that, of course, children are more vulnerable. But quite frankly, I had been sitting at many knees, and I didn't have any, when I say sitting at knees, I mean incredibly wonderful experts, not only you, Helen, Dr. Helen Caldicott, but Dr. Rosalie Bertel, Dr. John Goffman, Dr. Stephen Wing. There's a lot of people I have learned from over the years, and I've learned what texts they turn to and you turn to. And quite frankly, none of them talk about this. And so I had just sort of been a little flat-footed, you know, and sort of said, well, you know, if you can't tell me where you heard that, I'll have to look into it, and had never looked into it until the Fukushima disaster came. And it was actually the founder of Susan Komen for the Cure who wrote a letter to the New York Times saying that she had a deep concern for the women of Japan and their exposure to radiation because of this terrible disaster. And my boss, Michael Marriott, wanted me to send a letter to the Komen Foundation about this issue. And I said, well, I really can't do that until I track down this rumor that I've heard. And I think you have, you know, taught people this, but I needed a source. And so it was when I called Dr. Rosalie Bertel. She said, well, they're not going to say anything, but look at the numbers in the National Academy of Sciences report. And so I did. And in those numbers, which you have to question that whole report on a number of fronts, and we can talk about why, but in those numbers of cancer incidence and then also cancer death, this is comparing men and women at the same level of exposure to radiation, so 100 rads or, no, millirads, excuse me, or one full rad, are the two categories that are reported. And in both of those groups, it's just about exactly 50% more incidence of cancer in women compared to men, and 50% more cancer death in women compared to men. And this is astounding. It's a huge difference, and especially when you consider that worldwide overall total cancer, women tend to be far less than men, 25 to 40% less.
Less what? They're less what?
So if you have a cancer rate for men and a cancer rate for women just being reported as the totals, women have a lower cancer rate.
Like lung cancer and bowel cancer and stomach cancer? I mean, overall cancers.
Total aggregate cancers.
They have a lower incidence of cancer rate than men.
Than men. So it's not even a level thing and then radiation is bouncing it up. It's taking women who are on the whole less prone to cancer and then making it 50% higher.
And so what you're saying is that when women are exposed to radiation, X-rays or radioactive material from nuclear power plants, their risk of developing cancer is 50% higher than men.
Yes.
Even though in the normal population, the normal cancer incidence is lower in women than men for each particular cancer category.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Now, I'd like you to explain carefully, Mary, to people, what is the National Academy of Sciences and what is the BEAR-7 report and how was it developed so that people really understand this important document?
Well, the National Academy of Sciences is a nonprofit organization in the United States, but it's very closely affiliated with the U.S. federal government. Most of the work that's done through it receives funding from the various executive agencies, whether it be the National Cancer Institute or the National Science Foundation, or right now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is putting money to the National Academy of Sciences to look at radiation impacts in reactor and other commercial nuclear facility communities.
In America. In America.
In America, right. So this is a United States institution of many years and is based in Washington, D.C., and they recruit participants to be on the various panels. And the one that has published the report that I'm talking about is a panel called The Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation. And that panel has largely been stacked in favor of nuclear technology and nuclear industry background people. They're not exactly an independent group. And so the fact that over the years they have upheld the findings that there is no safe dose of radiation, that children are more vulnerable. And then in this report, which is the number 7 in this series, they're called BEAR because it's the acronym for Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, so number 7, is the one where all of this data is reported. It's not actually data because they've manipulated it. It's not raw data. It's findings in tables. And in these tables are these differences between male and female. But interestingly enough, this group of scientists chose to be completely silent about this gender difference. I don't really know why. It's possible that the uncertainty in all of their numbers is so high that they're not sure that this difference exists, but I think not. I went after I published the paper last October, and the paper again is called Atomic Radiation is More Harmful to Women, and it's posted online, about 8 pages long, and so I went to all these different federal meetings and stood up at their public comment microphones and gave short synopses of this paper. And when I got to the last one, it was happened to be the international body that was meeting in Washington, D.C., the ICRP, which is the International Committee for Radiological Protection. And they are kind of the front organization internationally for all these different, like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission bases its radiation standards on this international body. So I get to their microphone for a 5-minute comment and tell about my paper, and surprisingly enough, they laugh and clap.
They
were being supportive. And then, you know how academics are. This was a symposium and many papers were being presented, and I was sitting in the front row, and all day the different presenters, when they got to anything about gender, would turn to me and try and explain to me what they were doing. I don't really agree with their approach, but they are trying to come up with a reference human being, acknowledging that there is this difference, that if you only talk about men, you're not protecting women. That's very important. You know, we have a constitutional democracy in the United States that has the words in our Constitution that you get equal protection under the law. Well, what does it mean when you have women who are being so disproportionately impacted and children who are even more disproportionately impacted? How can we say that we're getting equal protection under the law when all the standards are based on men? So anyway, these guys are telling their papers but turning to me and explaining that they're creating a hermaphrodite as their reference human being. It's going to have one breast and a prostate.
And one testicle.
It'll have, you know, a testicle and an ovary. And I don't think this is going to do it. But it does acknowledge Rosalie Bertell's theory. It's not, we don't know exactly why this difference is there yet.
I don't understand, Mary, from my reading of the literature, and I've read pretty vastly as well, where does this data come from that women are twice as sensitive to ionizing radiation as men and get cancer at double the incidence compared to men?
It's not double, and it's not twice. It's 50% more. So you can picture.
Oh no, it's 50% more. That's not double. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So if you picture two men being impacted with fatal cancer by a certain dose level,
yeah,
then three women will be impacted in that group.
It's one in three
at the same dose level.
Okay, but where does the data come from?
Well, the National Academy of Sciences, in their infinite wisdom, has ignored absolutely everything about Chernobyl, which makes it a very weak document because we have so much information that has happened since the explosion of a full reactor core, which is so different than Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the horror of destroying those cities, but then studying the people afterwards. You know, pretty much all of the data in the biological effects of ionizing radiation is based on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which makes it a very limited analysis, really.
Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. But what my specific question is, where did they discover that women were 50% more sensitive to developing cancer when exposed to ionizing radiation than men? Where does that data come from, Mary?
Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors.
Oh, it's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Oh, really? Okay, so let's go back. What I want you to explain to the audience, Mary, is how the radiation standards or the standards for radiation exposure were derived from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and what the defects are in that analysis in a nice, simple way so people can get it.
We've got to separate those things because there's a mythology that we developed the radiation standards from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors.
Right.
But if you look at the actual history, the standards that we have were set before that study ever started. So there's a mythology about that.
Okay, well, explain all this.
Well, it's just that there was a group of people who were overseeing the Manhattan Project, and they included doctors who were beginning to use radioactivity in their practices, and they were trying to establish exposures that they considered acceptable. And, you know, I think it's worth taking a moment to frame it up, because at that time, you know, in the first half of the 20th century, there were not hundreds of radiologically active industrial-scale operations scattered all around the United States and the rest of the world. There were limited places where there was any amount of industrial scale radioactivity going on, and these sort of pioneers in medicine who were beginning to muck around with it. But it was a rare occurrence. And so the radiation standards were not set for the public. They were set for how much could you give to a worker or allow yourself as a doctor to have to consider that acceptable and okay as an industrial occupation or as a medical occupation. Those got generalized to the general public in the wake of hundreds of such facilities being built. But, you know, they started out as a very limited application, and they assumed that the people being exposed were young, military, enlisted males. And that is the basis for our regulation to this day.
But how did they work out? How did they work out how much exposure that these young, fit males could be exposed to? Was it just arbitrary? They just picked a number out of a box? How did they work it out?
They had some idea, because there had been lethal exposures, as to how much was going to kill you. And they had some idea of how much seemed to be, you know, didn't notice it at all, couldn't imagine that there'd been any impact from it. And they erred towards the low end, and it was completely arbitrary.
It was a guess.
Yeah.
It was a guess.
Absolutely. But in addition to the guess, when they created, see, there's a type of unit of radiation that you can measure the energy that's coming off of a radioactive element directly, and that's called a rad. But when you go to talking about the exposure to living tissue, you change the thing into a REM, and that's a computer-based model. And that model itself assumes a male body. And the impact on that body is also assumed to be a male body. And so the very units in which we measure dose have in them a gender basis.
Oh, really?
I think what we're coming to today is the realization that our current concept, not only the level of dose, not only the number that you put on being permissible to give someone, that that's still not enough. That the whole concept of dose is not fully formed. That there's too many factors that have to do with who is getting the dose, not just how much, that change the outcome. Is it an embryo? Is it a fetus? Is it a little girl? Is it a little boy? I mean, boys and men get cancer from radiation. It's not that they're safe. It's just that they are safer. Because women are, girls are disproportionately higher in ratio to boys than even women to men.
Yeah.
In the 0 to 5 age, little girls are twice as vulnerable to getting cancer at some point in their life if they're exposed during those first 5 years. Compared to little boys. And little boys will get sick. It's not that boys are safe. They're not safe. But it's a complex picture that we have never factored. And right now we have a playing field that is so tilted towards assumptions that come from, you know, almost 100 years ago that are no longer valid.
Okay, so
and
the
no longer valid for so many reasons.
The assumptions from 100 years ago, as you've just described, were guesses. They knew how much killed people, like 250 REMs would kill 50% of the population. And then they worked out that, you know, much lower doses don't have much harm. So they just extrapolated wildly with a guess to say, well, people can be exposed to this, this, and this. And the people were actually, what they're talking about was a 70-kilogram young, a standard man. Now, so at that point in time, when they worked out the doses to which people can be exposed, which are still really used now, they hadn't even got in the data from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, had they, Mary Olson?
They had not.
Okay.
And we need to talk about the limitations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki
also.
The first piece is you know, we have to just first acknowledge that cities were vaporized and that a whole lot of people were just gone. And then we have to acknowledge that it was 5 years before the survivor study began. So the first 5 years after the devastation and fireball and intense radiation, but it was just a gamma burst from those bombs. Most of the radionuclide fallout did not fall on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It fell a distance away. Mm. So in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, these are people who survived a big flash and blast and gamma rays and intense, you know, some amount of neutron exposure, but it was not the same at all as what we see when radioactivity comes out of a nuclear power plant on a daily basis in non-accident conditions, and certainly not comparable to what happened in Ukraine, Belarus, and across the entire Northern Hemisphere with a lot of deposition in Western Europe when the Chernobyl fuel was pulverized by the explosion and burned with the graphite. That deposition of plutonium and all of the fission products from that nuclear fuel is substantially different than Hiroshima and Nagasaki's moment of a single boom, you got exposed. And, you know, so it's a very, very limited study, really.
Okay.
So the most healthy people are the ones who made it through those 5 years. The most radiation resistant are the ones who made it through those 5 years. And plus, there was not any real effort to control the fact that a lot of people left and a lot of other people came in. And so the groups are very complicated, and many people were in the study group who didn't belong in there at all. So it's a very flawed effort. And yet it is, to some degree, a very valuable effort to have tracked all of these people throughout their life. And so the data that the Biological Effects of Ionizing Radiation, BIR-7, publishes is very limited. But on the other hand, it is a real world group of people who did go through that exposure. And then, of course, it depends on where they were and how old they were, and many factors were put into figuring out what that group of people represents. But it's very limited. Fukushima is completely different.
I'm interviewing Mary Olson, who's a biologist and a Southeast Regional Coordinator with the National Information and Resource Service in the United States. Now, so just to cap what you've just said, Mary, it was the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission set up by the United States who came in 5 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki to look at the remaining survivors and study their cancer incidences throughout time. And incidentally, some cancer categories are still increasing or appearing so many years later. So each cancer had a different incubation time, or what we call latent period of carcinogenesis. Leukemia started occurring at 5 years. Solid cancer started occurring at 15 years, like breast and lung and thyroid and the like. And even now we're seeing new cancers appearing, like cancers of the genitourinary tract and multiple myeloma in the bone marrow. But as Mary pointed out, they lost 5 years of population, where during that time post-bomb, many people's immune system was so badly damaged, people died of pneumonia and infections and meningitis, and children died. So the data that we still currently use today relevant to the atomic bomb survivors is not accurate, because we lost 5 years' data. They didn't bother to look at the people who were dying of all sorts of immune complications and the like. They started 5 years later. And the other thing to emphasize on this study is that although America is still studying these people, they were never insured. They never got any health care at all. All they were used were for guinea pigs. Now, so we established it from that point on, when they started studying this data. This is the data that is used now to work out how much radiation to which people can be exposed. And it's external radiation. It was a blast of gamma radiation, which is just like X-rays. It came out when the bombs exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So Mary Olson, what I want you to do now is move on from that external dose, which is used by the ICRP, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, by the International Atomic Energy Agency, external data, external radiation exposure from the atomic bombs, to what we're dealing with today with Three Mile Island. You don't have to go into each accident, but generalize Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima. What is the difference between the data that is totally used and avidly stuck by these organizations, and what they don't take into account was that the fallibility or the vulnerability of women and children, which is apparent in the atomic bomb data, to what is happening today with people being exposed to radioactive material in their food, in the air, and the whole thing, Mary, which is not ever taken into account when they work out what doses people can be exposed to.
Well, the fundamental issue that is so different between, you know, your water may not be very radioactive. It might be just a little radioactive. Your food might not be consistent. You might have one product that's completely clean, but you might be having a fairly regular intake of another item that unfortunately has got concentration going on in the food chain and concentrating radioactivity up, you know, either because medium fish eat little fish, and so bigger fish have a tendency, if there's radioactivity, to have a much higher level. Same for people who eat dairy. The cow eats the grass, and the grass becomes concentrated in the body, and then even more concentrated in the milk. And then if you make cheese, it's even more concentrated. So what's not being looked at is the transmission of radionuclides that cannot get inside the body because the skin is protective if it's just floating around in the air. But if you inhale it or you drink it or you eat it, these types of materials that have particles rather than energy waves, they're known as alphas and betas, they can be up to 1,000 times more damaging, each one of them, than an X-ray. And it's because of the same reason that your skin keeps them out. The particle is so big, it bounces off your skin, but if it's in the soft tissue of your gut or gets transmitted into some other organ in your body through your circulation, if it, you know, gets into your lungs and it stays in your lungs, that alpha damage and beta damage can be catastrophic by comparison to the gamma. And there are laboratory studies that have shown that it would take 1,000 tracks of an X-ray to do what one alpha particle can do to a chromosome, to DNA, can actually, you know, rip cell membranes, can break chromosomes. Damaging DNA when it's in its repair cycle is something that happens typically with a reactor-originated form of radioactivity, because things like cesium and strontium have two modes of decay, and the first one can trigger the repair mechanism, and then the second one comes during the time that the DNA is most vulnerable while it's trying to repair itself. So this, you know, radiation damage is to our cells. Unless you have really, really high levels where you're getting burns, and then you could say larger areas of the body are directly impacted, this type of ongoing exposure in our air, food, and water leads to the inability of our repair mechanisms to keep up or our repair mechanisms to function correctly. Well, and that is when you start having the greater potential for cancer.
So explain to the audience, Mary Olson, what are these radioactive elements? Walk us through, you know, like six of them, and tell us what elements they resemble in the body, which organs they migrate to, how they can cause cancer, and how they're formed in a nuclear reactor. How are these radioactive elements made?
All right, I'm going to start with that end of the question and let you talk about the concentration in the body, because I always get things turned around. I'm not good at retaining the exact associations. But needless to say, radioactivity does move through our body. And where does it come from in the first place? Well, we dig uranium out of the ground, and we go through many steps of purifying it, because the ore is not just pure uranium, so we mill it, and that takes out all the other stuff. Now we have uranium that has to have a special concentration of it done, called enrichment, which takes the one type that will split and increases the concentration. That's the U-235 will split. When it's finally made into fuel rods and put into a reactor core and all the right conditions are put in place, so you've got liquid and you've got enough of what's known as a critical mass and you've got all the right conditions, the nuclear chain reaction begins. And in a reactor, it's exactly what goes on in a bomb, except for that you put a clutch on it, as it were. In both cases, the goal is generating heat. In the case of a thermonuclear bomb, you're using that heat to vaporize cities and horrific things like that. In the case of nuclear power generation, you're going to all this trouble to do one thing, which is to boil water. And so the heat is the primary goal of the activity, but the enduring long-term consequence of splitting the uranium is the formation of elements that were not there before you started the process that build up inside the rods that are the fragments of the uranium atom. And these are things like cesium and strontium and iodine and bromine and a whole alphabet soup of elements that are smaller because they're the fragments of the nucleus of the uranium atom, and they are highly radioactive, meaning they are spitting off energy and having disintegrations per second many, many, many times greater than the original uranium. So the irradiated fuel, once it's used and comes out of the reactor core, is about 6 million times more radioactive than the uranium that went in there. And that's thanks to all of these things called fission products. And then the final thing I should mention is that while there are traces of plutonium on our planet, the industrial scale quantities of tonnage quantities of plutonium come from the uranium that doesn't split. The U-238 in that reactor core is also being hit by little neutrons at the right speed. And when that happens, the U-238 becomes plutonium-239, which is the bomb maker's plutonium. It's the one they love to use to vaporize cities. So it's kind of this big circle.
I want to say to the audience, you may hear some drumming in the background. We're sitting in a studio in a little fishing village in Australia, and the roof of this little studio is made of corrugated iron, and so it's making a drumming noise with the rain on the roof. But please persist and listen to what we're saying, because I'm sure you can hear it very clearly. But just know the background noise is actually rain.
Now, it's our planet.
What I want to now talk about, I'll just fill in where Mary left off. I'll just talk about sort of five of the elements that are made when uranium atoms split apart randomly. But there are actually 200 radioactive elements made in a reactor as the uranium fissions continuously. Some only last milliseconds, some last seconds, some last years, some last days, some last for centuries, and some last forever. So I'll pick four. One is cesium-137, and you'll be reading about this from Fukushima and indeed from Chernobyl. That is a very volatile element when there's a meltdown, like at Fukushima or Chernobyl. That escapes, and cesium-137 has a half-life of 30 years. You multiply half-life by 10 to get its total radiological life, so it's around for 300 years. But Mary Olson, she says you multiply it by 20 to get its total radiological life, which means it's around for 600 years. And cesium is very like potassium, and our body cells are rich in potassium. So cesium migrates to the muscles, which are rich in potassium, and to the brain, which is rich in potassium, to the testicles and ovaries and the like. And cesium emits two sorts of radiation. One is gamma, which is like X-rays, which the people at Hiroshima and Nagasaki were exposed to. And one is a beta particle, which is a little electron, which, as Mary explains, gives a very high dose to the surrounding cells in the tissue where the cesium is located. And the thing about cesium is it'll stay there for a long time once it's in a muscle or in the brain. And so you don't just get one dose of radiation like zap, like an X-ray, or zap like when you walk through the X-ray machines at the airports, which you should never do, incidentally. It continues to irradiate those cells for as long as it lasts in the body, and it may be years. Now, that's the first one. Second one is strontium-90. That's got a half-life of 28 years, right? That's a calcium analog, so strontium goes to the bone and the teeth, where it can irradiate cells to cause bone cancer or leukemia. The next one is radioactive iodine, which you've heard a lot about, and that only lasts, well, its half-life is 8 days, so, you know, maybe it lasts for 80 days or 160 days, whichever multiplication unit you use, and that goes directly to the thyroid gland. And it's a very high-energy gamma emitter, like X-rays, and it also emits beta radiation, that electron. And as such, is a potent carcinogen for the thyroid gland. And we are already seeing children in Fukushima province now, prefecture, who are developing tumors in their thyroids, and it's only a year since that accident happened. The last one I'll describe, and it's not the least, but it is the last I'll describe, is plutonium-239, which was manufactured in the Manhattan Project to make nuclear weapons. That's a fuel for bombs. And it is the most deadly substance that we almost know, such that a millionth of a gram can cause cancer if it's deposited in your lung or your bone or your liver, or crosses the placenta and damages the embryo. And plutonium lasts, well, its half-life is 24,400 years. So you could say it lasts for 500,000 years. And that's, I've only described four of them. And as I said, there are several hundred. So these are the elements, and this is the radiation, the internal emitters, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the International Commission on Radiation Protection, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission do not look at. Is that so, Mary Olson?
Well, it's the internal exposure that is not included in any of the studies or documents upon which the radiation, and they're not protection standards, they're allowable limits. They're essentially a bag limit on the population. How many people can you kill? And
yeah.
So the internal exposure is not included.
In how many people you can kill. It's just external.
In other words, you're killing a lot more than you think you are because you're not including that.
Yeah, so when there is an accident like Chernobyl or Fukushima, there is not much external dose. Say when it first happens and you're a person walking around the street in Tokyo and you're enveloped in a cloud of radioactive gases like cesium and radioactive iodine and lots of other things, you could get a quick dose, a quick flash of external radiation, like gamma radiation, like they're exposed to with the bomb, right? And the cloud blows away. But the more important thing that they're not analyzing or taking into account is what you inhale in that gas or what you ingest in that gas. Right, Mary?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, we shouldn't look past the workers. I mean, look over the workers. The workers are where the external dose and the internal dose are, you really worry about somebody getting a pretty healthy external dose if they're on the Fukushima reactor site.
Right.
Or if they happen on some debris, which, by the way, some of those explosions spread quite a lot of highly radioactive debris around that whole part of Japan. And now with the stuff that's been coming across the ocean, there's real concerns for people walking on the beaches of the west coast of North America because they may encounter, unbeknownst to them, highly radioactive debris as well. So it's very worrying, really.
Yeah, but the thing I want to emphasize in this interview, Mary Olson, is the extraordinary irresponsibility that almost takes my breath away, that they're actually not measuring or taking into account the most important elements of radiation exposure to the Fukushima population, the Japanese population, the European population, the Ukrainian, the Belarus, the like, or people
correct.
On the West Coast.
You are correct. And every reactor community and every fuel fabrication community and every radioactive waste dump community. I mean, there's a lot of places where radioactivity has been leaking into water, where people have been exposed without their knowing it, where the rain comes down radioactive and nobody says so. And then I'll add my current theory, which is, think of all the women in radioactive occupations. I mean, people who fly on planes all the time, people who work with radioactive patients in nuclear medicine settings, who administer X-rays, who work at nuclear power plants and everywhere else that has a radioactive element of their occupation. And they've never been told that they are 50% more likely to suffer the consequences than their counterparts who are male. They do this on a daily basis without disclosure to those workers, and I'm very upset about that. And it's worldwide. It's not only in my
well,
country.
Well, so am I. And now I want people, when they go and fly a plane, to look at those goddamn X-ray machines at the airports that they're installing.
Oh, we have a phrase. Here it is. It's a bumper sticker, but we haven't had them printed yet. Skip the scan. Go for the grope.
Skip the scan, go for the grope. Look, I tell them, you can grope me and I don't care what body or orifices you examine, but I'm not going to be exposed to radiation. And there is evidence now that the people who work around those machines are developing some illnesses. That's just anecdotal, but I have read that. Those people don't understand radiation. And they're right next to the machines. I don't know what dose they're getting. I don't know what dose people are getting when they walk through the machines. But let's be frank, Mary Olson, fetuses are being exposed to X-rays. And we know that fetuses are thousands of times more vulnerable to radiation and getting cancer than adults.
Well, I think it's absolutely telling that the people who work in those locations don't even know that it's radiation. They don't know it's ionizing radiation. When I went recently on a flight, I don't fly very often, but when I did, they told me upside down and sideways that it was not radiation, when I knew, looking at the type of equipment, that it absolutely was one of these new backscatter scanning devices that is ionizing radiation. And I said, I'm skipping the scan. I'm going for the grope. And so, you know, every direction that I went, that's what happened in Jacksonville, Florida, and in Boise, Idaho, I went for the grope.
So they call they've said that to me too. They said, look, it's not X-rays, it's backscatter. But that's ionizing radiation. It is X-rays, right, Mary?
It is ionizing radiation. And there has been a letter from a number of medical doctors questioning the dose calculations that were used to approve this thing and saying that they had a deep concern about how close to the skin gonads are and breast tissue, and that there really was not adequate protection in the
well,
Fisher Plus.
What I'd like to say is that it doesn't matter what dose you get. You should get no dose of radiation, because all radiation is damaging to genes. Each dose you get is cumulative. That no dose is safe, and that they're exposing now large segments of the population. And apart from the risk of getting cancer or damaging fetuses or the like, the most important thing to note is that the genes in the eggs and sperm get mutated by radiation. So what you're doing is increasing the incidence of abnormal genes, which will carry disease down through future generations. And what these machines really mean is random compulsory genetic engineering in human species for the rest of time.
You are absolutely right, Helen. It is a scale of experiment beyond our comprehension. And it's why I call nuclear dirty energy. You know, a lot of people are using that term for fossil fuels,
yeah.
They're also dirty, but there is nothing clean about radiation.
No.
And so I'm tired of calling for green energy or renewable energy or sustainable energy. My new call is for healthy energy, that we need to power our society with things that do not make us sick. And obviously the fossil fuels are making us and our planet sick, but so is nuclear, is making our planet sick and making each one of us have a much greater risk of having some horrible disease. And as you were talking about, over time, it is not clean energy.
Yes, well, it really just takes my breath away. Now, Mary, you want to extrapolate and enlarge upon your work relating to the fact that women and children are so much more sensitive to radiation than men, not that men aren't sensitive themselves. So what is your plan to educate the whole population of America about this, Mary Olson?
Well, I actually want to reach beyond the population of this country. This is truly every woman, everywhere, every type of radiation, all the time. It's the whole shebang, Helen, and I guess I was raised that knowledge is responsibility, and knowing that day in and day out, so many women are at so much higher risk without their comprehension or any type of disclosure given to them, that I feel like that's step one, simply sharing the knowledge and information. And interestingly enough, I feel that it's as much an opportunity to turn back to the academic community, to the medical community, to even the people who are working in the industry that I spend a lot of time challenging, people in the nuclear industry, to share this information. And on the one hand, it's an altruism, and on the other hand, as an activist and an organizer, I know that the only thing that really changes the world is political will. And on nuclear right now, there's a lot of propaganda that nuclear is the only answer to getting rid of coal plants and stabilizing the climate, which it never has been an answer for. But there's a lot of people who are just kind of being passive about it and thinking, well, okay, all right, it's a necessary evil. And instead, we need the political will to be going the opposite direction, because nuclear sucks up all the money and does not deliver the climate goals. We have to not spend the money on nuclear so we can spend it on the right things, which are stopping wasting energy and instituting distributed generation as appropriate. If you've got a lot of sun, then solar. If you've got a lot of wind, then wind. You know, start phasing all that in. And spending money on nukes in the meantime is the wrong idea. So we get a whole lot of people very angry about this stuff is where I'm at.
Good.
There's
good.
A word that I can't say on the radio, but, you know, manure storm is a stand-in for it.
Why can't you
manure storm,
why
huh?
can't you say SHIT? That's so stupid. I mean, you know, you've got to be able to use relevant words for relevant situations. But anyway, look, Mary Olson, I thank you so much for this interview. It's been absolutely fascinating and imperative information for everyone to understand in this nuclear world today.
Thank you, Helen, for having me.
That's a pleasure, Mary. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this very important interview today. Know that the background noise is rain falling on an iron roof in our little studio in a little fishing village in Australia. Nevertheless, listen to the words and use the rain just as background noise and know it's actually watering our vegetables and our plants. So thanks for listening today to If You Love This Planet. I've been speaking with the wonderful Mary Olson, a biologist who is a Southeast Regional Coordinator with the National Information and Resource Service in the US. And if you go to their website, NIRS.org, NIRS.org, you'll find her paper on the extreme sensitivity of women to radiation, which is never talked about compared to men. Not that men don't get cancer from radiation as well. So thanks for listening today, and we'll have another really interesting interview for you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.